You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and glad to be back in my seat. Thanks so much to Carl Frisch for so ably filling in for me for the last 2 days. Carl's a great guy, as you probably got to know, and I encourage you. He's trying to get to his 10,000th tweet follower, so get over to Twitter and follow Carl as a thank you for being on my show. It's pretty thankless work, and it's not as easy as it seems. I'm here, and I'm pretty sure I'll be here all 3 hours. You won't probably hear me doing much shouting or that kind of thing, because I know what I had is bronchitis, and I think it was associated with the flu, because the day before yesterday I spent the whole day in bed, unable to even, I mean, just staggering, you know, to get to the bathroom kind of thing. Yesterday I could get up and walk around from time to time, but and so today I'm walking kind of not in a straight line. But you know, the interesting thing about viral diseases, which this almost certainly is that by the time you have symptoms, what causes the symptoms is this flood of cytokines, these antiviral white blood cells, you know, the antiviral antibodies that are produced by white blood cells in your body that overwhelm the viruses. And it's basically like chemotherapy, you know. And when people take chemo, it knocks them down. So when you got the flu, which is what I'm guessing happened to me, and that it showed up in as bronchitis, by the time you've got the symptoms, you're not contagious anymore. By the time the symptoms are starting to go away, you're definitely not contagious anymore, because you've just got this overwhelming amount of, you know, chemotherapy in your blood, your body's own cytokines. So I'm sitting here in a soup of cytokines. Excuse me, you could tell, right? And but we've got a lot going. There's a lot going on today that I want to talk about, and that I think is some really important stuff. Plus, we'll be taking your calls. Plus, we've got some interesting guests. But the first that I'm going to mention now, and I'm going to get into in a little bit, is probably one of the number one talking points that you're going to hear on all the right wing. There's two big number one talking points that you're going to hear on all the right wing talking shows, all the right wing shows right now. The first is the result of a piece that went out from the Heritage Foundation. Of course, the Heritage Foundation, funded by the Koch brothers and Fred Coors back when he was alive, or Joe Coors rather, back when he was alive, and I believe the Scaife Foundation and others. And the Heritage Foundation, you know, has sent out this report to all the right-wing talk show hosts. And, I got my copy of it. And you can read it over at heritage.org. And they say that we're perilously close to economic and social collapse because so many of us are overtly reliant upon the government for our survival. It says that our dependence on the government has increased 8.1% and in 2010 and so on. It goes through this whole thing. Turns out, though, that buried in the report is the statistic that gives the lie to the report. That by dependence on the government, what they're talking about is people on Social Security, people on Medicaid, people who've retired, and of course you got the Bush Great Depression that we're in the middle of, you know. So there's people on unemployment. Heaven forbid, people on food stamps. Although, as I've pointed out many times, there were more new applications for food stamps during the Bush administration than during the Bush administration. The second talking point that's going out to all the big right wing talk show hosts, and especially you're especially going to hear Hannity pound on this, but others, is that the Catholic Church is under attack. Now, I pretty much don't have a dog in this fight. I was raised in the Methodist Church, and other than walking by the Catholic school every day and dating a couple of women called girls, actually, back in the day, who went to the Catholic school, that's pretty much my... Oh, and one of my very, very best friends in the world, Wayne Teasdale. One of the most incredibly wonderful, decent, and humane guys I've ever known in my life, Brother Wayne Teasdale, who I spent time with in New York. We used to do workshops together at Omega Institute. I spent a week together with him at the Dalai Lama's home in Dharamsala, India. Wayne was a disciple of Father Bede, who was a Catholic priest who had this ministry in India. And Wayne was just this amazing guy. He spent 6 months out of the year as a professor, a teacher, at the Catholic University in Chicago. I forget the name of it, but there's a big university there where they teach basically priests how to become priests. And so Wayne taught priests how to become priests 6 months out of the year. And then 6 months out of the year, he spent as in India with a begging bowl, with a vow of poverty, literally homeless and penniless, going from home to home every morning begging for his food and doing good works, helping people. And as part of Father Bede's whole thing, and B-E-A-D-E is how that's spelled, if you want to Google Father Bede and Wayne Teasdale. Wayne Teasdale wrote several books on mysticism. I wrote the blurb for one of them. He wrote a nice blurb for my book, The Prophet's Way. And several years ago, I hadn't heard from Wayne in a year or so, and I was trying to track him down, and we had a mutual friend, and I called her up, and actually Louise called her up, and said, we haven't heard from Wayne in a while. Do you know how to get in touch with him? And she just burst into tears. Wayne had had just a sudden, he died suddenly, an aneurysm kind of thing. Anyhow, I learned a fair amount about how brilliant and how compassionate Catholics can be from Wayne Teasdale, and the mystical side of Catholicism, and the institutional side as well. But that's about it. Like I said, I don't have, so much of a dog in this fight. But the way that the argument is being framed, that the president is saying, if the Catholic Church wants to run a hospital, and a Jewish doctor wants to work, or a Methodist doctor, or an atheist doctor wants to work at that hospital and have health insurance, that she should be able to have her birth control pills paid for by the health insurance. And 28 states already have this law, and many Catholic organizations already do this. It's relatively non-controversial. But the guys on the right have seized on this like the president has declared war on Catholicism. And I got to tell you, this is not about bad Catholics. It's and I realize there was a bishop's letter about this and all this kind of thing, but it's about bad governance. The fact of the matter is that if the Seventh-day Adventists, I'm familiar with Seventh-day Adventists. They're vegetarian. I mean, they gave us a lot of help when we started the Community for Abused Kids back in the 70s because it was a vegetarian program. And the Seventh-day Adventists, Loma Linda University, they have their own medical school. They operate hospitals all over the country. They ultimately were forced to serve meat to their patients. And they kind of go along with it. But they went along with it. But the bottom line here is that it's not about Catholicism. It's the real issue that we should be discussing that we're not is that we don't have a national health care system in this country. If we had a national health care system in this country, then the religious institutions could provide health care by their own people to their own people on the fringes. And this wouldn't be an issue.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We as a country have to have both religious freedom and have health care as a right for all. I don't understand how that's getting lost in this discussion. Welcome back. And Tom Hartman here with you. And I think our bumper croaked. Paul, can you pull up clip 6 here? I want to play this for our listeners. This is John Boehner talking about President Obama saying that if a church wants to run a hospital, then they're going to have to conform to the standards of other hospitals. And, you know, you have to wash your hands, you have to provide surgeries, and if you're going to offer health care, then these are the standards for health care. Here he is.
If the president does not reverse the department's attack on religious freedom, then the Congress, acting on behalf of the American people and the Constitution that we're sworn to uphold and defend, must. This attack by the federal government on religious freedom in our country must not stand and will not stand.
See, I just don't see this as an attack on religious freedom. I mean, I see this as a failure of the United States to have a national health care system. I personally would have no problem, just like, you know, I have friends who are Hasidic Jews, and I've spent for that matter I've spent time in Israel in the most Hasidic areas, or for that matter I spent time in Egypt with people who are very, I guess halal is the word, and on Friday in Egypt you don't work, and on Saturday in Israel you don't work, and here in the United States the Seventh Day Adventist hospitals, you take Saturday off, you know, and it's like they honor those religions, and because they have national health care systems. So, you know, if the Catholic Church wants to do it their own way, God bless them. But right now, the problem is that we have such a bass-ackward health care system that we're relying on the good graces and charities of you know, decent and caring people in the Catholic Church to provide healthcare services to us, when instead and that's fine if they want to do it. I mean, you know, that was Matthew 25. I'm preaching it all the time. It was one of the number one injunctions of Jesus Christ, was to heal the sick. And, you know, good on you. But it should be the purpose, it should be the job of the state first and foremost. This is not a war on religion. It's a failure of state. Hey, Rick Santorum, trying to turn this into a war on religion. Clip number 7, please, Paul.
They are taking faith and crushing it. Why? Why?
Threat.
When you marginalize faith in America, when you remove the pillar of God-given rights, then what's left is the French Revolution. What's left is a government that will tell you who you are, what you'll do, and when you'll do it. What's left in France became the guillotine.
Well, Rick there is portraying a startling ignorance of the French Revolution, first of all. The Catholic Church had controlled much of France for a long, long time, and until Mr. Napoleon came along, who was actually post-French Revolution. But one of the things that the French Revolution did is they kicked the church out. And not only did they kick the church out, they went nuts. I mean, you know, not just the Catholic Church. They kicked all the churches out. And they renamed the days of the week because they were named after Roman gods. And they renamed the days of the month because they were named after Greek gods. And they reset the year zero because that was dated from the birth of Christ. And, I mean, it was a total... The French Revolution was going the opposite direction. Rick Santorum seems to think that, A, this is an oppression of religious rights. And I would argue that, you know, you could make that argument. But more importantly, it is a failure of the state to provide health care to its people, which should be a right, not a privilege. And then once you've done that, then people like me who are vegetarian and who try to actually, you know, I don't know how much I should get into this in my personal life here, but I try to observe the Sabbath on Saturdays. Okay, I don't call myself a Seventh-day Adventist. I'm not one. I've never become one. But I think that Saturday is the day you should take off. And so people like me, if I wanted to check into a hospital, I'd prefer to go to Seventh-day Adventist Hospital. Frankly, I can get a good, healthy vegetarian meal, and Saturday's a down day. But let everybody else go to the hospital that they want, that's run, you know, that's paid for by the government, that's part of a national health care service. And if somebody's Catholic and they want to have know that the people ministering to them are Catholics, and that there's a chapel, you know, easily available to them, and if they need a priest right away, they can get one, and you know, by all means. And if they have unique, and if somebody's an Orthodox Jew and they have particular, you know, or a Hallel Muslim and they have particular food oddities, as it may be, or oddities is the wrong word. You know what I'm talking about. I'm sorry. I'm kind of in a Robitussin haze here, but you get the point. Let it happen, but let it be on top of and beside a national healthcare system, not part of a national healthcare system. The problem we have, the reason why it's possible for people like John Boehner and Rick Santorum to get demagogue this issue, which is what they're doing, make no mistake about it, is not because it's right or wrong to tell a religious institution that, hey, if you're going to get into the business of doing something other than being a religion, although you can make a strong case that Jesus said heal the sick, and so healing the sick is part of your religion. I acknowledge that. But what we should be saying is healing the sick is the goal of all of society. And that when we do it, when all of society has it done by certain standards. And if somebody wants to operate outside those standards, for their people, by their people, God bless them. But we need to have a national health care system in this country. How come that's not being discussed in the corporate media?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Well, because it's much easier to try and turn it into a war on church, on religion, or it's got to be, you know, secularists against the Catholic. Come on. There you go, a beautiful blue sky day here in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. And close to belting out the show today. I'm alive and kicking, and we're doing well. Let's get some of your thoughts on all of this. Eleanor in San Obispo, California. Hey, Eleanor, what's up? Is it San Luis San Luis Obispo?
San Luis Obispo. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Great. Yeah, no, I just wanted to make a comment. I think people are forgetting that you don't have to be Catholic to work at a Catholic hospital, and you may not share those values. And as an employee, you are entitled to fair benefits like every other institution gets.
Well, that was my point. If all of our health care was provided for without the need for Catholic hospitals, then
correct.
Catholic hospitals certainly could continue to exist and would continue to exist as they do all around the world. And
exactly.
They could then say, this is a hospital of, by, and for Catholics, and we're going to run it our own way. And I frankly don't have a problem with that, just like I don't have a problem with Hasidic Jews having their own hospital, or observant Muslims having their own hospital, or Seventh-day Adventists having their own hospital. But we need a friggin' national healthcare system. And that's the big problem, is because the Catholic hospitals are part of our national healthcare system, then I think you can make a strong argument to say, okay, you're going to play as part of the national system, you have to play by the national rules. You know, that argument makes sense to me. On the other hand, the argument, hey, wait a minute, we're a religious organization doing religious work, we'd like to do it our own way. That makes sense to me too. And so it seems to me like we're arguing the wrong argument. The argument should be, this is happening because we don't have a national healthcare system unlike every other country in the world. Making sense, Eleanor?
But a rebuttal to John Boehner is the fact that there is not a litmus test to work at these hospitals, that you do. There's nothing on the employment application that says, are you Catholic?
That's right.
If you say yes, you get fired.
That's right. And see, if you want to become an altar boy in the Catholic Church or work in the Catholic, I realize that in many of our churches now, you know, in order to work in the church, you can still be some other religion. I'm not all that I don't have that much of a problem with religious, if you want to call it religious bigotry, with churches saying, you know, if you're going to work in this church, you have to be a member of this church. Because churches are not part of the commons. Hospitals are part of the commons right now. They shouldn't be part of the commons. Eleanor, thank you for the call. Very, very well said. Sarah in Arcadia. Hey, Sarah, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. I just was listening to your last caller, and I have her same take, I think, on the Catholic hospitals and other institutions such as universities. These universities are run for profit. They are private. They hire mostly lay people. Often there is not even a cleric at the head of these hospitals anymore. And so the people that work there, women particularly, need to still have an advantage of being able to have these kinds of drugs that help them with their periods and prevent unwanted pregnancies available to them so they don't have to pay for them. And you're right about a national health care.
Yeah, system. Once again, this is a symptom not of a problem of religious freedom or religious bigotry, but of the fact that we don't have a national health care system. And if we did, we wouldn't be having this debate right now. Sarah, so well said. Thank you so much. Kellen in Illinois. Hey, or Zellan, is it? X-E-L-L-A-N. How do you pronounce that?
Zellan.
Zellan. Hey, before. How you doing?
Not bad. How are you?
Great. What's up?
Two things. And I'll get back to having worked at a Catholic hospital before. But remember in the 1980s, under Republican administrations, the United States was virtually at war with the Catholic Church in South America, including the assassinations of several prominent Jesuit archbishops and priests, including Oscar Romero.
The Catholic Church has so often, all around the world, in modern days, in the last couple centuries, the last century in particular, has been at the forefront of progressive change and of positive change. And I mean, Father Berrigan, you know, of people, or the Berrigan brothers, for that matter, of peace, of justice, of, you know, I absolutely honor that. As I said, this is not an issue of Catholicism or versus government. It shouldn't be. And the reason that the Republicans are able to demagogue it this way is because we don't have a national health care system. And it's just that simple. Zellan, thank you very much for the call. Well said. Heartland in Los Angeles. Hey, Heartland, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, first of all, you don't sound well. You need to get rest. But I want to point out that when I'm a lawyer, and when, as a lawyer, I look at rules and I read rules, and I read this rule that the Health and Human Services, and this is just out for circulation and comment, but it says in there, if your purpose is religion, you can apply for an exemption.
That's right.
So we have to ask ourselves legally, is the purpose of a hospital religion? And I would argue that it's not. But I also looked at these 28 exceptions, and I wanted to convey to you and your listeners that when I looked at these yesterday, Ohio didn't have an exception. The Ohio rule, which requires birth control be provided, was enacted, from what I can remember from yesterday, in the year 2000. It's been around for many years. Boehner's from Ohio. I don't recall hearing one peep out of that guy regarding the Catholics of Ohio or the religious institutions of Ohio.
Yeah, and Ohio is one of 28 states. But again, you're turning it back into back onto the field, onto the battlefield that the Republicans are trying to establish.
I want to change the battlefield. The battlefield is the Republicans want us to actually subsidize religion. That's not the point of the government. We're not going to help them make their case about not having abortions or not having birth control. Let them take their religious argument out in the marketplace of free ideas and make their argument to the people, convince them not to have an abortion and convince them not to use birth control.
Well, all of that
to make the religious argument that makes this stuff an issue.
Okay, Heartland, well said. Thank you. But again, this has nothing to do with abortion or birth control, in my opinion. This has to do with the fact that we don't have a national health care system. Andy in Flemington, New Jersey. Hey, Andy.
Oh, how you doing?
Good.
Catholic hospitals, that is the Catholic teaching, is not to have, contraceptives.
Sure.
So they can never.
And one of their teachings is also to heal the sick, and I get that.
Right. So you can't force them to use that. A lot of good hospitals around of all nationalities,
sure,
or religions. You can't force whichever religion it is and what they believe. You can't change that. then you don't go to the hospital. And why are hospitals using contraceptives anyway? Don't they go to the
This is the health insurance plan the people who are the employees of the hospital. This has nothing to do with the patients. This is for the guy who's the janitor. This is for the doctor who's doing the surgery on you. This is for the nurse. This is for the administrators. This is for the woman who sits there, or the man who sits in the billing office and processes your insurance card. Whether or not their health insurance plan will pay for birth control pills.
Then the Catholic Church should say, if you want to work here, this is our teaching. We cannot participate in that.
See, and I don't disagree with that. It's just that the problem is you can't say that until you have a national healthcare system, because otherwise that hospital is part of the commons, and that's the horrible conundrum. You know, this is why President Obama finds himself in this catch-22. It's because we don't have a national healthcare system. This should not be an argument about religion, and it shouldn't be pick on the Catholics thing. This should be, and I'm surprised that the church itself, that the bishops haven't, this is something John Paul II pointed out, that health care should be a right. George in Bloomington, Indiana. George, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. It's a privilege to speak to you.
Thank you.
I've read several of your books. Well, one thing I want to talk about is you talk about the housing thing. Two brief things I want to mention. If you go back to the Levittown era, we built housing based on affordability. We made every effort to keep property prices low. And
you're talking about the early 50s.
Yeah, well, the late from like 47 on to 1960.
Right.
In 1960 was the first time we had like 5 years of inflation without deflation, and the real estate industry caught on that you could buy property, turn out, pay off, sell the property a few years later, pay off what you owe, get a chunk of profit.
Right.
So everybody all across society, this mentality permeated that, you know, property always moves up in value. It's a great investment as opposed to a human necessity.
I got your point, George. And we should cover that on another day when we're talking about that topic. Gary in Sarasota, Florida. Got a minute to the break, Gary. What's up? And thanks for listening to 95.5 FM.
My question about health care with the churches, there's actually hundreds of unions and companies have been excused from or opted out of the health care system. Isn't that opposite of what Obama wants? And also, couldn't he just let them opt out?
I'm not sure I understand what you're saying. I don't think this has to do with the health care system. I think this has to do with employer, being an employer, and having to do those same things that other employers have to do.
Yes, there's a number of unions who don't have to follow the rules of Obamacare, and because this falls under the Obamacare, just like the unions and certain businesses have gotten out of it, why can't these hospitals get out of it?
Yeah, Gary, this has nothing to do with Obamacare. I'm sorry. Or maybe somebody will correct me, but I'm pretty sure this has nothing to do with Obamacare. And I'm surprised nobody's called and pointed out that I'm taking a very radical position, that I'm in favor of religious.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I'm in favor of religious organizations being actually able to discriminate. We'll be back 45 minutes past the hour.
Oh, everyone believes.
Okay, just to recap, this whole, frankly, I think, to some extent, I don't want to say manufactured debate, because there's a legitimate debate here, but it's being made hysterical, histrionic, by Mitch McConnell and John Boehner and Rick Santorum and Fox News. Healthcare and religious freedom seem to have come into conflict. And the reason that they have come into conflict is because religious freedom is considered a right in the United States and healthcare is not. Let me say that again. The reason that these two, that religious freedom and healthcare, are in conflict right now have nothing to do with Republicans or Democrats or Santorum or Obama or any of that. It's because health care is not considered a right and religious freedom is. And until the United States joins the other developed world, countries of the world, every single one of which, most of them in their constitutions, and the United Nations, by the way, in the UN Charter, which we're a signatory of, acknowledges that health care is a right and not a privilege, you're going to have these kind of messy situations. So, anyway. Isabel in Van Nuys, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Isabel, what's up?
Hello. I'm not a Christian Scientist, but I used to be, and I know that they, you know, don't go to doctors and stuff like that, and they have some health insurance programs that will cover Christian Science treatment. But I also know the Christian Science Monitor is no longer, not all of the services are located in Massachusetts.
Right.
So I know that they don't necessarily, you know, I have a feeling. I've been trying to find out online, and maybe one of your listeners knows, if you work for the Christian Science Monitor, do you have health insurance? I believe you probably do, because I know that the church said that if the property was not used for religious services or religious-related activity, they would pay the property tax on, and they did pay. They do pay property tax on non-religious buildings in their in Boston.
Right.
So I'm thinking they probably cover health insurance and don't have this question.
Yeah.
Because it's in a non-religious building.
Yes.
That you're working in.
Yes. Although, what if the building that we were talking about was the building where Christian Scientists go to pray to heal other people?
That's called, you have to pay your taxes as a practitioner. You would have to pay your taxes. There's no question about that.
Really? So
they,
your income as a physicians who earn an income at a Catholic hospital pay income taxes also.
I'm no longer in the religion. Right. They don't have clergy, so you can't claim a clergy exemption.
Oh, I see. Okay.
You are a practitioner that has gone through certain programs with the church to become that, but you're not considered clergy.
Right. I think then that it's an imperfect analogy, but I understand your point.
Yeah, well, I'm just trying to say, I'm sure if we looked at other religions, we probably would find some of them would cover it, even though they might not agree with. I'm just saying this is, like you were saying, it's overblown. It's being puffed up as a big thing.
And the thing that we should be talking about is, why don't we have a national health care system so we can stop these petty arguments on the fringes and deal with the core problem, which is many people in America don't have access to health care.
I've gone when I was in London, I needed to get a shot. I can't remember what it was because it was going on to Africa. And I went in and they gave me a shot, no charge.
Yeah, I've had the same experience.
Here you'd pay an arm and a leg.
Excuse me. Yes, I know. I'm absolutely with you. Thank you, Isabel. Shannon in Mountain View, Michigan. Hey, Shannon, what's up?
Yeah, I'm from Montague, Michigan. I just wanted to make the comment that you were talking about the monopolization of the Catholic Church in our healthcare system.
Yes.
In our area in particular, in Muskegon, all of the local hospitals have been converted to Catholic-associated healthcare, and now we don't have any choice on where we want to go.
Right.
So we're kind of forced to go.
Right, and this is where and this isn't like some giant conspiracy by the Catholics. This is what's happened is that we don't have a national health care system.
Well,
and
that's
so
right. I know a lot of this has occurred because of the county hospitals closing, and so they filled the gap there. You know?
Yeah, yeah. And we need a national health care system. It's just that simple. And then you can let the Catholics practice their medicine the way that they want to, with the people that they want, under the rules that they want. And you can have the observant Jews do the same, and you can have observant Muslims do the same, and you can have Seventh-day Adventists do the same. And thank you, Shannon, for the call. I'm still surprised nobody's calling me a religious bigot. I'm amazed. Steve in Evanston, Illinois. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Listen, piggyback on your subject there. You know, back in the Caribbean, a lot of the churches, When people are hungry, they go to the church for food. When people are sick, they go to the Catholic Church for medical, because a lot of the local governments do not have the kind of money resources we have here. So,
well, or they have those resources, but they're all going to the fat cats who are stealing it.
That's pretty much true. Still yet, it seems like we don't have that kind of discussion. And like the gentleman who just spoke before me was speaking, you know, you're left with a de facto doctrine from, you know, the church in his community in Michigan, just as it would be back, you know, home in Belize for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I so honor the Catholic Church for taking seriously Matthew 25 and you know, arguably Matthew, 7 through 9, 5 through 7, whatever it is, the Sermon on the Mount. And you know, Jesus' injunction to heal the sick. I absolutely honor that. And we need to have a national health care system in the United States. And it's such a tragedy that the Republicans are trying to politicize this thing and turn it into something other than a discussion. I'm surprised that the Democrats, frankly, aren't turning this into a... Well, of course, they're not going to turn it into a debate about a national health care system, because, you know, they've already, you know, sort of got one. But anyway, we'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. And I understand my old friend Seton Motley is at the Conservative Political Action Committee, which is today and tomorrow. I was going to be broadcasting from there, but my health is rather marginal today, so I didn't want to show up. Have I reached the argument desk at CPAC?
First of all, it's the Conservative Political Action Conference, not committee. We're much bigger than just a committee.
So this is the argument desk.
Yes, it is the argument desk. How are you? So I'm sorry you're under the weather.
You don't know that old Monty Python routine?
Yes. Oh, this is abuse. I'm sorry. You win an argument. This is abuse. Oh, okay. Thank you.
Sorry.
Well, this isn't an argument. You're just contradicting me.
At least you have some cheese.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So, Seton, what's going on at CPAC?
This parrot has ceased to be.
He's just pining for his pals or whatever.
CPAC is very good. It's unbelievably packed. There's a lot of people bopping around. I got here kind of late today because I had some work to do out back at my joint. But it's I bopped around, and I think it's even bigger than last year. So I think it's going to be a really cool couple of days.
That's remarkable. I wish I could be there. I had certainly planned on it. We're talking with Seton Motley, lessgovernment.org. Seton, the three consecutive losses by Mitt Romney.
Yes.
The last year when I was it 4 years ago? I think it was 4 years ago. I've been at every CPAC for the last 5 years. It's the first one I've missed in a long time. And 4 years ago, there was a bunch of people walking around in dolphin outfits, and they were giving out a giant flippers to people with Mitt Romney's name on them.
Right.
You know, like the flip-flop guy.
Yes.
Is he getting abused that badly today, or has the are the conservatives starting to form ranks behind the guy?
No.
He's got the billionaires. He's going to be the Republican nominee. There's no doubt about that.
I think there is doubt about it. The conservative base is not thrilled with Romney. We know this. I don't think it's a fait accompli yet that he's the nominee. I think that the Holy Trinity on Tuesday shows that it's not a fait accompli that he's going to be the nominee.
But he's spent more money so far. I mean, or the Political Action Committee, funded by billionaires from Wall Street, has spent more money so far on his campaign.
You're just angry about the billionaires on Wall Street aren't giving more to Obama. That's your problem.
Well, they're actually not. They did four years ago. I'll give you that, but they're not this time. And the point is, I can't imagine why they would want to stop.
Imagine why that would be the case.
I think Dodd-Frank might have something to do with it. But in any case, he has already spent more money just on two states, South Carolina and Florida, than John McCain spent in the entire campaign on independent expenditures. I mean, it seems to me like, you know, he's got the bucks, he's got the money. Ricky Santorum is going to be the nominee?
I'm telling you that money is at once the most overrated and underrated element in politics. You know, just because he's raised a ton of money doesn't mean it's a guarantee he's going to be the nominee. I think you guys on the left get way, way, way too worked up about the amount of money people raise.
Well, it's 98% of the time the person, on the one hand, 98% of the time the person who spends the most wins. On the other hand,
you just said the
gubernatorial and senatorial race in California showed us that Meg Whitman and Carly Fiorina were not able to buy their elections. So you're right. You're right. I'm just wondering who you think is going to be the nominee.
Oh, I have no idea.
If it's not Romney.
It changes from day to day, so it's hard to predict. I think Santorum, the Iowa thing didn't really give him a second, a real second look.
Right.
I think the three wins on Tuesday are going to cause conservative voters in the Republican primary to actually give him the second look.
But this is a guy who lost his own state by like 14
points.
Yeah,
but that was 2006. That was not a very good year to, Bob Casey ran as a pro-life Democrat, and then it turned out he wasn't a pro-life Democrat. He lied his way into office, and he's going to lose again. He's going to lose his seat this year. 2006 was not the best year ever to run as a Republican. So,
this is really the story you guys are telling yourselves.
Well, that's what. Am I incorrect in that assessment of 2006 as not being a very good year?
I don't know. I look at Rick Santorum and I just see a guy who doesn't seem to me like he has the intellect or the gravitas or the emotional
rock
solidness.
Barack Obama off his teleprompter is a doofus. He's not a smart guy.
I don't believe that's true.
Go search YouTube, Obama Flake. I made a video. It's got over a million views.
Okay.
Obama Flake. It shows time and time again how completely unlucid Obama is when he's not reading something.
All right.
He's not a very... I'm tired of hearing about how Rick Santorum's not smart,
you're,
but Barack
you're on
Obama's
the record
not.
And you believe you have proof that Obama's a flake. The question is... Who's not a flake on the Republican side?
I think Mitt Romney's a smart guy. He's been very successful in business. I think Newt Gingrich is probably the brightest guy to run for president in quite some time. And I think Santorum is perfectly capable intellectually.
I'm surprised I've not heard you mention anybody who's not in the race right now. I mean, if we go into a broker convention.
Because they're not in the race.
Well,
we're
if
not
we go into
go
a broker convention, you don't think that it's going to be Marco Rubio?
We're not going to go to a broker convention. It's not going to happen.
I don't think so either, and that's why I think it's going to be Mitt Romney. He's already got three times more delegates than anybody else.
Yeah, well, but that's...
I realize it's only 100 to 35.
I was going to say, that's like, that's like being the tallest midget. There's only been 135, 135. You need 1,100 and change to win. So, his big lead now percentage-wise is not...
What's the hottest issue that's been what's the red meat that's being tossed around right now by the speakers at CPAC?
I haven't seen too many of the speakers, but it's what's in the news, which is Obama eviscerating the First Amendment with Obamacare. That's a big deal. That's a big deal. You're
talking now the First Amendment and Obamacare in the same sentence. You must be making the leap of having the Catholic hospitals
forced to provide services they find morally repugnant.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Like
we actually spent the last hour talking about this. My take on this is that they should have the right to do whatever they damn well please, and so should any other hospital. But before you get to that point, we need to have a national health care system so that those hospitals are operating on the periphery.
Where in the Constitution does it authorize the federal government to provide national health care?
In Article 1, Section 8.
No, it doesn't.
Yes, it does.
It totally does not.
It's right there in the Constitution.
Excuse me.
Congress shall appropriate money and make laws to provide for the general welfare of the people.
No,
Is life not general welfare?
Wrong.
You are not pro-life, Seton?
If the founding fathers wanted the government to provide
health care...
I thought
you were pro-life.
Tom, shut up and listen for a second.
If you were pro-life,
Tom,
you want people to stay alive.
Tom, if the founding fathers wanted the government to provide health care, why did it take till Obama in 2009 for the federal government to provide health care?
Seton, do you know the name of the first president to sign into law legislation that provided government-paid health care?
Yeah, it's the military, yes.
No, it wasn't. I'm talking about civilians. Do you know the name of the first president to do so?
Washington.
Exactly.
But that doesn't mean he did
it. Then why are you saying that it
because
took
it's
until
not an
Obama?
Was it a national one-size-fits-all policy?
No.
No, it was not.
It was
no,
not.
It was not. It had
there
nothing.
Were only 13 colonies
that,
at the time.
That's,
excuse me.
Yeah, that's my point. The point is, if the founding fathers wanted the government... Look, there's a reason the Constitution...
They did.
No, there is a reason the Constitution mentions a lawyer and doesn't mention a doctor. It's because they wanted you, the government, to provide you a lawyer. They did not want you to provide you a doctor.
I would submit to you that the definition of general welfare, the general welfare of the people, has changed over the years as the cost of health care and the sophistication of health care has changed.
Bull.
And I agree with Scalia that the Constitution is a living document.
You know what it is? If it's a living, breathing document, the amendment process is the respiratory system. And until they amend the Constitution,
Article 1, Section 8
does not provide for government
general
medicine.
Welfare.
General
it's right
welfare,
there in the preamble.
First of all, that's not an enumerated power of the Constitution.
It absolutely is.
No,
it's in Article 1, Section 8.
It's general welfare. It's not enumerated power. It's a general proclamation. Enumerated powers are in 1 through 10, and then 10 says, if it ain't here, it doesn't belong in D.C.
That's right.
There is nowhere in 1 through 10 that says
general welfare
government should
health.
Provide medicine.
How is health not welfare?
Because it's not.
Okay.
Because they would have said health if they said health.
Semantics.
They meant welfare.
Seton Motley, it's always good arguing with you, Seton. Thank you for coming by. You fulfilled the argument desk admirably.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Seton Motley from CPAC, lessgovernment.org. Thanks a lot, Seton. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And just a couple of things from our chat room, and then we'll pick up your phone calls here. Seawater notes in our chat room. I looked up Brother Wayne Teasdale, and it says he succumbed after a long battle with cancer. Way too young, it seems. It's clear he devoted his life to good works. R.I.P. Brother Teasdale. Wayne had cancer, and he had radiation therapy for it in his neck. And it was... To the best of everybody's understanding, it was knocked out. And Paul, I'm hearing things in my ear. I don't know if your mic needs to be turned off. Thank you. And apparently what happened was the radiation therapy weakened the carotid artery, the blood vessel, or weakened some blood vessel in his neck, and he had just this massive aneurysm and died from that. So he died from the treatment, unfortunately. At least that's my understanding of it. I mean, I learned this a year after the fact from a friend of a friend. So, but Wayne Teasdale is somebody, I believe several of his books are in print, and he's really worth looking up. And, secondly, Rich says you should have gone to CPAC just to infect all the crazies and take them out for a few days. I hope I'm not contagious because at least I'm in a separate room from everybody else here, and I'm trying to avoid everybody else. And I would not want anybody to have what I have had over the last couple of days, and I really genuinely believe I'm over. Scott in Skowhegan, Maine. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, let me get my TV. I've got to mute it. There we go. Yeah, I got a couple of things I'm just going to throw at you, and then I'll let you say it off air or whatever.
Okay.
First of all, I want to know where the Attorney General stands on this banking thing. I mean, why are they so afraid to fight these people and put them in jail for felonies? And second of all, I'm curious to know how Spain, or is it Italy, coincides with the Vatican. They have a public health care plan over there.
Yeah, Italy has a national health care system.
Yeah, and I'm just kind of wondering how that steps off with the Vatican and whatnot, because them people have got to be covered by health care.
Yeah.
And with that, I'll turn you loose, guys.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Scott. I appreciate it.
I listen every day, dude. You do a great job.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for your kind words. Just like with, what was on the internet about Brother Wayne, I don't know the details of the healthcare system in Italy, and given that healthcare has gotten so politicized, I'd be real wary of anything I read on the internet, because there's white right-wing groups who are literally paid to scrub the internet and rewrite things. So I just honestly, I don't know the answer to that question. The earlier question about what's the deal with this healthcare settlement, and this is a really important issue. And in fact, I don't want to spend 3 hours talking about the Catholic Church. There are other things happening in the world about this deal that the president has made. Because I think, within 24 hours, you're going to see the president walk this thing back, figure out some kind of a compromise. But this deal to let the banksters walk is almost a done deal. And apparently Attorney General Schneiderman in New York and Attorney General, was it Harris, I believe, Kamala Harris, in California are on board with this. And there's two issues here, in my personal opinion. And they point to the tragic horror that has become a corporatized America, a corporate, you know, which is purely the result of the Supreme Court. There's no other way to describe it. And that tragic horror is that, A, I think the president believes, well, I don't know what Obama believes, but, you know, Eric Holder and the Justice Department have to be involved in this process where they're negotiating with these 50 state AGs, attorneys general. You know, they're the senior law enforcement officers of their states. He's the senior law enforcement officer of the United States, where they're basically saying, okay, you guys ripped off American homeowners. Right now, American homeowners in mass are $700 billion underwater. $700 billion underwater. That is probably somewhere between 10% and 35% of the total losses as a result of what the banksters did. But just that, if they were to go to the banksters and say, cough up $300 billion and take everybody who's underwater and bring them up to zero so they have no equity in their home whatsoever, but they at least owe exactly what their house is worth so they can sell it tomorrow if they have to, which a lot of people are trying to do because they need to move to get a job. If they had just cut that deal, I think it would be a great thing. But instead, they're doing this $25 billion deal, which is working out to about $1,800 per person, which is, in my opinion, woefully inadequate. Now, why would they do that? As I said, two reasons. The first reason is that this is probably, in the opinion of the administration, the best deal they can get. And there are some changes in banking practices that they're trying to get the banksters to make that they can't make by legislation because the Republicans control the House of Representatives. So they can't force them through. And previous legislation, when Republicans owned the House of Representatives, like Gramm-Leach-Bliley and the Commodities Futures Modernization Act and other pieces of legislation like that, mostly promoted by Phil Graham and his conservative buddies, still allow the banksters to rob you and rip you off. So this is like the last leverage that the administration has to force the banksters to start behaving in a way that's even partway right toward people. So I think that's the equation that they're doing is, okay, we'll let a whole bunch of people not go to prison, and we'll take a settlement that is a pittance of what it should be, in exchange for which we'll get the banksters to behave well, because there's no way that we can get this through the House with John Boehner and Eric Cantor there, number one. And number two, and this is the really sad part, and this is why I think it's a $25 billion settlement instead of a $300 billion settlement, because I think without this it would be. They know that the banksters on Wall Street have enough money that if they just dropped $1 billion into the election, they could wipe out all the Democrats.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, geeky science. Can fasting help cancer as well as bronchitis and the flu?
I'll show you just how cool scientists are. We study everything, that's why we're cool. And yes, most of us got high marks in school. And proud. Paleoanthropology.
Indeed. Our moment, and we'll get back to your calls in just a second. I see all our lines are full. But our moment every week when I get to share with you my favorite topic, which is science, actually. As much as I love politics, I love science even more. And this was published, Agence France-Presse is writing about it, but it was published in the journal Gerontology by a professor at the University of Southern California, Walter Longo, a couple of weeks ago. And it's about mice with cancer. And it shows that when mice are fasting, it weakens their tumors and helps chemotherapy knock out their tumors. And so the conclusion that they're drawing from this is that having people fast for a day or two before and a day after their chemotherapy might actually make their chemotherapy radically more or somewhat more effective against chemotherapy. They also said that fasting protected normal cells against chemotherapy. Now, how does this happen? And they did this with breast cancer, melanoma, glioma, and human neuroblastoma, a variety of different types of cancers. There's an earlier study back in 2000. I mentioned I haven't eaten in 3 days. This morning, Louise made a smoothie for me. I had a few nuts and maybe a cherry and a raspberry or something in the blender, but that's all I've had in 3 days. And I think it's, my thing whenever I get sick has always been fast and take a long hot bath, try and raise my body temperature, you know, increase the fever, because that gets your body to really knock out the cytokines, the things that are going to nuke your virus or whatever it is. This is a study, this is in 2003, a study by Mark Madison, PhD, who found that intermittent fasting works because each fast to the body is a mild stress, and that stress produces stress resistance proteins, a particular type actually. It's called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BNDF, which, by the way, promotes learning, memory, and the growth and survival of nerve cells, and that periodic fasting actually makes a person more resistant to Alzheimer's disease. That's kind of cool. So, anyhow, that's my science. Pardon me, sneezing here. So, let's get... Actually, before I get back to your calls, a couple of other things that I wanted to share with you really quickly. Did you know that there are companies in this town who work for companies on Wall Street in New York, in this town being Washington, D.C., who they're called political intelligence firms. And their job is to talk to people on Wall Street, to talk to people in Congress, members of Congress or employees of members of Congress, and find out about legislation that's coming up that will probably pass or may fail that will affect the stock market. Like, you know, members of the Defense Appropriations Committee know that there's a $20 million contract that's going to be awarded to Boeing next week. Nobody else knows. If these political intelligence firms can find that out, then they buy a whole bunch of Boeing stock, or they don't even buy the stock. They bet on the stock. They buy a bunch of options on the stock, a bunch of puts, and because that's a much more highly leveraged deal, and turn $1 million into $1 billion really, really fast when the stock goes up 10%. This is legal. Because there is this weird exemption, this weird loophole in the law that allows members of Congress to benefit from inside information. And there's some strange legal membrane through which they can transmit that information. And it must involve winking and nodding and body language or something, you know, something like pitchers and umpires. I honestly don't know the details of it. That allows them to transmit this information through these political intelligence firms to traders on Wall Street. And so traders on Wall Street hire these political intelligence firms at very high prices. And these political intelligence firms then take that political intelligence, hand it off to Wall Street. Wall Street makes money on it. You would think that it would be a crime. It's not. Chuck Grassley added to the Senate stock bill a provision that would make that a crime. Nothing more, nothing less, just that. And Chuck Grassley is a Republican. He added that to that bill. The bill passed something like 97-3 or something like that, some incredible majority out of the Senate, went down to the House of Representatives, and guess who took it out of the bill in the House of Representatives? Eric Cantor. It's no longer in the bill. The news reports are reporting the House bill differs from the Senate bill, so it will have to go to House-Senate reconciliation. Yeah? You want to know how? I just explained it to you. What I find interesting is that we now have, you know, Republicans against Republicans. It's pretty amazing. Chuck Grassley, you know, came out and you know, just went off on this the other day. He was very upset about it. But so anyway, John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up in the state of Minnesota, our voter registration is one of the most liberal in the country, and you can vote and register the same day that you vote.
Yeah, and there's nine states that allow that, I believe.
Right, and the Republican legislature has maneuvered the law now so that they're going to put it on the ballot that we have to have a driver's license. And unfortunately, most voters really don't understand the ramifications of that, right, that it will disenfranchise at least three groups very heavily, the elderly, students, and people who, oddly enough, lose their driver's license, which in this state, according to officials, it's about 20,000 people a day lose their driver's license, and if they lost it on election day, they would not be able to exercise.
Well, there's a fourth group, and those are people who live in a big city and don't drive, or who are so poor that they've never been able to afford to buy a car, and therefore have never gone down to get a driver's license, which is a significant minority of the minority population.
Right, and unfortunately,
Democratic, by the way. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, unfortunately, Keith, the DFL, which is what we call the Democratic Party here, is not going to take it up. But it was presented by Keith Ellison in a caucus just the other day to make it part of the DFL party agenda. But they won't take it up because, you know, they don't see that it's a winnable issue with the electorate. And I just think it's horribly underhanded. Even though our Democratic governor vetoed this legislation, they were able to maneuver it through a loophole to put it on the ballot.
Right.
And, you know, it's going to – we've had some elections here where like Al Franken was – there were 250 votes between him and the other person.
Right, and had students and elderly people and African-Americans not been allowed to vote, he would not have won.
That's right.
Yeah. No, I'm with you, John. And we reported on this either last week or the week before when the Republicans did get that on the ballot in Minneapolis and in Minnesota, rather. And it's a horrible thing. And, you know, the Republicans, the only way they can win is to knock people off the ballot. And that's why they're all about voter disenfranchisement. It's that simple. So, John, thanks a lot for the call. I mean, there's just no other way to say it. Gail in Seattle says you disagree with me. You go to the front of the list. Hey, Gail.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call. Mm-hmm. I do disagree with you. I don't think you can get to the health care reform, total reform of a national health care, until you get religion out of the state. And the
why is that?
The church, because it will be a fraction. It will be just an item that will always be an item of contention. The hospitals are part of the commons. I agree with you on that. The churches are not part of the commons. Within the four square walls of the churches and the four square walls of your house, freedom of religion absolutely exists. Once you walk out of there, your religious freedom has to mesh with the commons. A hospital, as long as it doesn't remain a hospital, solely staffed, solely owned, solely taking care of one religious group, is not completely a religious institution. It can't be.
I don't disagree. I don't disagree. So, and we don't disagree, Gail. I have been saying all along that if hospitals of any religion, and this has already been tested in court and acceded to by the Seventh-day Adventists long ago, that look it up. That if, you know, if any religion wants to participate in the commons, and I think the hospitals are part of that, in that business, then they have to play by the rules of that, you know, that the government has established for that industry. I also think that Obama's going to walk this back because of this firestorm of controversy. But my point is that he shouldn't have to walk it back, and there shouldn't even be a debate, because there should be, we should have religious organizations that want to have their own hospitals for their own people, run by their own people. And that can only happen when we have a national health care system. But Gail, I agree with you. We don't disagree. We'll be right back. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The thing that just astounds me, Talk Radio News is up next, by the way. The thing that just astounds me is that nobody in the corporate media is talking about this, that this should just be national health care. Fix it. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com, on the line with us, brought to you by Ellen Ratner's new book, Self-Empowerment, 9 Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st, by Ellen and Ann Gaiman. And Victoria, greetings.
Greetings to you, too. Well, I know you've been talking about the contraception issues. So, in other news,
okay,
the Nuclear Regulatory Commission voted 4-1 today to build the first new nuclear power plant in more than 30 years, in spite of objections of the panel's chairman.
Wow.
And NRC Chairman Gregory Jasko cast an extraordinary dissenting vote, saying, "I cannot support issuing this license as if Fukushima never happened. I believe it requires some type of binding commitment that the Fukushima enhancements that are currently projected and currently planned to be made would be made before the operation of the facility. Very concerned about safety stemming from Japan's disastrous 2011 Fukushima disaster."
Where is this plant that they just issued the license going to be located?
It will be located in Georgia. The units will cost Southern Company and Partners about $14 billion and enter service as soon as 2016 and 2017.
Wow. And they're going to put it, what, on the Chattahoochee River?
It doesn't say here exactly where. There will actually be two power plants.
Or on the Chattahoochee. I lived in Georgia for like 15 years. I would think either on the Chattahoochee or on the Atlantic. That's very interesting. Okay, what else is up?
Also today, the Obama administration announced, and President Obama gave remarks about this, that after months of painstaking talks, government authorities and 5 of the nation's biggest banks have agreed to a $26 billion settlement that could provide relief to nearly 2 million current and former American homeowners who have been harmed by the housing bubble. And it's part of a really broad national settlement aimed at halting the housing market's downward slide and holding banks accountable for foreclosure abuses. Now, under the deal, $17 billion will go towards reducing the $20,000 the principal that struggling homeowners owe on their notes. $5 billion will go to various state and federal housing programs, and the rest will subsidize refinancing by underwater but up to date on their payments homeowners. The 5 banks are Bank of America, JP Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, and Ally Financial.
But Americans are underwater to the tune in aggregate of over $300 billion, and this is a $25 billion settlement. How does that work?
Well, because that's the deal they were able to cut.
Okay. All right. That's what I figured.
I know. But one of the things they were pleased about is that they were able to get New York and California on board. This thing has been going on for over a year.
Yep.
California and New York were holding out because they felt, and it was the case, that the deal, the way it looked to be going down, did not include going after these banks that they were going to get off the hook. And under the deal, the prosecutors and regulators still have the right to investigate other elements that contributed to the housing bubble, like the assembly of risky mortgages into securities that were sold to investors and later soured, as well as insurance and tax fraud and other elements of criminal wrongdoing.
Interesting.
Today, the House overwhelmingly approved the lawmaker insider trading bill.
Conspicuously absent the provision that allows for political intelligence firms that Chuck Grassley had put in the Senate to take information from the House and give it to Wall Street. Eric Cantor removed that.
That's correct. The bill was approved 417-2. As you know, Chuck Grassley went absolutely ballistic about this yesterday, and said that political intelligence would remain in the shadows the way that Wall Street wants it. And indeed, it will remain in the shadows. There will be a study done.
Which just what we need. Yeah, let's do a study while these guys make a few billion more on insider information.
Yes, the feeling is that that House leadership has done Wall Street's bidding on this. Also, the feeling is that this part of the deal was done by Republican House leadership without Democratic input, without the input of the two Democratic sponsors of the bill, who've been trying to get this bill passed for 6 years.
Yeah, Louise Slaughter in particular. Hasn't this been her cause celeb?
Yes.
That's okay.
They also eliminated a provision backed by Senate Judiciary Chairman Patrick Leahy that would restore criminal penalties in some public corruption cases. Got rid of that, too.
Oh, my.
So getting rid of all kinds of things here.
Yeah.
Also, the payroll tax cut conference, the 20 conferees, they've met 3 days this week. They're still meeting in public. I think pretty soon they're probably going to go into private session. And you will be astonished to hear that they remain stuck. Today, Democrats rejected two measures related to unemployment insurance that Republicans really want. One of them is insisting, the Republicans insist, that people who get unemployment benefits be enrolled in a GED program in order to qualify for unemployment benefits. The other one is that they be subject to drug screening if choose to do that.
This is more of the let's whack the victims. What was you mentioned that there was a House conference committee that was stuck, and I somehow missed what the conference what the piece of legislation.
The payroll tax holiday extension, which expires
at the end
of this month.
So they're gonna hold that hostage right up to the last day, and then throw the Keystone XL pipeline or something in.
Keystone XL pipeline is still in, as far as the Republicans are concerned, as well as the boiler regulations are in, and as far as Democrats are concerned. A 1% surtax on income over $1 million is in.
Amazing.
So as you see, we are absolutely nowhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. What else?
And today, the Senate Judiciary Committee voted, this is really interesting, 11-7 this morning for legislation that would open Supreme Court arguments to television coverage.
Oh, I'm all in favor of that.
Yes.
And the, you know, Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution actually gives Congress the power to regulate the Supreme Court, so they can force this on the court even though the court doesn't like it. Do you think it'll pass Congress?
I don't know where it's going to go in the House. There is quite a lot of support for this. We'll see.
We'll see. Absolutely. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, the president rescues GM, and guess what? Michigan has a surplus in their budget. Of course, Rick Snyder, the Republican governor, is going to take credit for it. Very, very strange. Alan Dickerson is on the line with us. CampaignFreedom.org is his website. He's the legal director of the Center for Competitive Politics. CampaignFreedom.org is the website. Alan, welcome.
Thank you, Tom.
I understand you're over at CPAC.
I am.
Conservative Political Action Conference. I'm sorry, I couldn't be there. It was fully my intent to be. I understand that you're gung-ho in favor of super PACs?
Well, I mean, gung-ho is such a loaded word. I do think Citizens United was correctly decided.
So here we have Rick Santorum. This is just from today's New York Times. The few people played a more pivotal role in Tuesday's turn of events than Mr. Freese. They're talking about Foster Freese, mm-hmm. an investor who made millions in mutual funds and now lives in Wyoming. He is the chief backer of a super PAC that has helped keep Mr. Santorum's candidacy alive, the Red, White, and Blue Fund, at a time when Mr. Santorum could not afford to pay for a single commercial of his own. The Red, White, and Blue Fund focused in particular on Minnesota. They go through this whole thing. Basically, Without Mr. Freeze, Santorum wouldn't exist. Without Shelley Adelson, Newt Gingrich wouldn't exist. Without the Wall Street banksters, Mitt Romney would be like he did last time. He spent 40-some-odd billion dollars of his own money. He'd have to be self-funding. Isn't there something fundamentally wrong with the democracy that's based on how much money you have or who the friends are that have the most money?
Well, I mean, it's sort of begging the question. I would say there's something wrong with a democracy where you don't get any actual choice in candidates. And the alternative in the real world as we live in it is that Romney would have the nomination sewn up right now.
No, you're avoiding my question. Isn't there something fundamentally wrong with the democracy or republic or whatever you want to call our form of government where the person who has the richest friends has the highest probability of getting elected because he can own the airwaves?
If that was true, yes.
You don't think that's true?
I don't.
Then how do you account for, you know, Mitt Romney outspending Newt 2-1 in South Carolina and, you know, not quite beating him, but outspending him 5-1 on his main campaign and maybe 30-1 by outside expenditures in Florida and trouncing him?
I think it probably has something to do with the fact that voters in Florida like Romney more than voters in South Carolina.
I don't think
it's all that surprising.
You know, his PAC ran 13,000 ads in Florida. Newt Gingrich's only ran 200. You don't think that had anything to do with it?
I have no idea. And causation,
are you
know,
really
is a tricky
that naive?
Thing. Well, I mean, who's being naive?
You have no idea? You don't think, you know, if advertising doesn't work, then why do corporations spend billions of dollars a year on advertising on television?
Yes, of course advertising works, but advertising is not a direct line between success and failure. It's true that Romney's message probably got out a little bit more effectively in Florida.
So you see no problem in that. I mean, is there any way that you think that this, first of all, why do you think the Citizens United decision was properly decided by the Supreme Court?
Because I think that it shouldn't just be the press and people who have radio shows and the institutional parties that get to choose their candidates. And back under the previous regime, those were the people who were able to amass money and actually communicate their message.
Aren't there other ways to go about this?
I'm listening.
Okay, well, for example, in the United Kingdom, no candidate or anybody on behalf of that candidate can spend more than £100,000 in an election cycle. Therefore, their elections rarely last more than 6 weeks.
Well, they also get to call their elections on a snap vote. I mean, here we have scheduled elections that happen every 2 to 4 years under the Constitution.
But this has nothing to do with that.
Of course it does. It has to do with the reason,
the reason they happen so fast is because they know that they've got £100,000 to spend, $160,000, and once it's gone, and they got to stop talking.
No, Tom, the reason they happen so fast is the prime minister selects an election date, which is usually 6 weeks out. I mean, I didn't know we were going to discuss British constitutional law, but how it works.
All right. I would argue that's a consequence of the £100,000 spending limit more than it is the, you know, hey, I'm selecting an election.
Well, the rule
date
is quite a bit older than the £100,000 spending limit.
Okay. I understand that I frankly expected you to say, you know, what, you want spending limits here in the United States? Isn't that unconstitutional? How could we possibly reinvent our American democracy, our system, in a way where wealthy and powerful interests don't basically rig and run the show?
Well, I think we are. I mean, I think one of the major problems with this debate is that everyone hears the word super PAC and they sort of throw up their hands and say, oh my God, it's huge and scary. I mean, there's nothing about a super PAC that has to be supersized or mainly funded by wealthy individuals or major, you know, entities. A super PAC is just a vehicle by which various individuals or groups can.
But without Gingrich's super PAC, he wouldn't be a candidate. Without Santorum's super PAC, he wouldn't be a candidate. And frankly, without Romney's super PAC, he wouldn't be a candidate. And we might actually have had a more honest Republican primary if there had been no super PACs.
I doubt that, given the number of debates we've had, which I think, if you follow the news, have been extremely influential. I mean, you can't oversimplify these things, Tom.
Well, that's very interesting. So you think that we should be offering the public airwaves? Is that, I mean, so far the debates have been for the profit of the networks that ran them. Is there an alternative?
Well, I think the alternative is just that we as a society need to be breaking monopolies on political speech. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of people, you know, on the broadly defined left see Citizens United and super PACs as feeding into those sort of monopolies. I happen to take a different side. I think that previously there was a monopoly. It was basically people with radio shows like yourself, people who could
and
get
Rush
on TV.
Limbaugh.
And Rush Limbaugh. Yeah, absolutely. I'm not picking sides here. You know, and the institutional parties, both of them, who basically could handpick candidates, could handpick, you know, the message
and now
in elections.
And now it's Shelley Adelson and Mr. Friess.
It's still broader. And it doesn't have to be. I mean, I think you and I would probably agree that, you know, the thing that needs to happen here is that people who have grassroots interests need to get involved. They need to found their own super PACs. They need to amalgamate small money donations. And
but,
I think the Internet makes that possible.
What you're saying is that you're equating money with speech. And money is property.
No, I'm saying that money makes speech persuasive. I mean, obviously, I can go outside right now and sit on a soapbox. I don't think it's going to change any votes.
Sure. And I don't disagree that money facilitates speech. But what you're suggesting is that we should all get together and gather together as much money as possible. How does that, you know, again, what you're saying is that we should have a democracy that functions, or we should have elected officials who function based on how much money they get or they can raise. And it seems to me like that's the least important criteria that by which we should determine our candidates.
Well, no, we should determine our candidates based on substantive issues, based on substantive, you know, positions and views and character. And
so those issues, so the coal barons are going to get behind the guy who's the coal guy, and the oil barons are going to get behind the guy who's the oil guy, and the, you know, fill in the blanks, and you're going to have, and the Wall Street barons are going to get behind the Wall Street guy, and that's what we've got right now. We've got these dueling interests.
And you think that's the creation of Citizens United and not a just sort of ongoing situation?
I think Citizens United has made it worse, but I think that Buckley versus Vallejo actually was the first nail in that coffin, as it were.
Okay.
I think the concept that money facilitates speech was wrongly decided.
I disagree with that. I think it's just an economic fact. If you make it so that people who are not in the press can't communicate their political views, the press gets monopoly on political discourse.
No, there's a very simple way to do it. It's the same way that you did it in 1960 when Nixon debated Kennedy. You require the networks to carry the debate and not make a profit on it.
And do you think that's sufficient?
Well, it seemed to work in 1960.
Well, but again, it changes the fact that, okay, yes, you're right. Kennedy and Nixon, or, you know, they got their views out. They had their debate. Those, whatever, were stated. But I think a lot of where you and I probably disagree is that I think there's a lot of value to having third parties give their opinions on candidates. I think having candidates monopolize the discourse is problematic.
But the candidates are the ones who are going, you know, the candidate is the guy, is the man or woman who's going to be president, not the oil company that's backing him, not the coal company that's backing him, or not the labor union that's backing him.
I agree with that, but candidates have certain interests that may or may not be in favor of transparency. The fact of the matter is we can't simply allow the two-party system to determine what we do and don't know.
But even the Supreme Court was arguing in favor of transparency in Citizens United.
Of course it was. It was talking about a completely different type of transparency.
No, they were suggesting there should be legislation for Citizens
United. Well, no, they weren't, actually.
Okay, Alan Dickerson, campaignfreedom.org. Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Alan's over at CPAC. Campaignfreedom.org is his website. You can check it out. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. Neil, listening on K-Talk in Riverside. Hey, Neil, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how are we doing?
Great.
I wanted to point out how it's appalling that how Eric Cantor has such audacity to speak of free markets when what they're really obviously instituting here is basically Stalinism.
Well, it's crony capitalism. Let's not exaggerate things. We lose credibility when we do that. This is just, it's crony capitalism. It's giving your buddies inside information, and then your buddies make money on it, and then presumably they recycle that back to you in the form of campaign contributions. That's what Eric Cantor did by stripping this political intelligence provision out of the insider trading bill in the House of Representatives.
It's an absolute kick in the teeth of every and any free market theory that ever existed.
Of course, these guys don't believe in the free market.
No, of course not.
It's rhetoric.
You know, and of course. And in fact, it's rhetoric because they're undermining it. I mean, you know, that's the best way to hide what they're doing.
Sure.
Is to just point to the other guy and say, oh, communist, socialist.
Right. No, the guy who believes in the free market is Ron Paul. He wants no public lands, no public highways, no public roads, no public police, you know, everything you pay, you know, you pay for your fire department. I mean, privatize everything. That's Ron Paul. He's the only guy who has any integrity in this. I think he's nuts, but he's at least consistent. Eric Cantor uses the language of libertarianism, the language of the free market, all that kind of thing, and then he kills a deal that would make it illegal to for him and his buddies in the Republican side to pass off information to these political intelligence firms, who then pass it off to Wall Street traders, who then make billions and billions of dollars on legislation that's about to be passed or about to be killed. You're absolutely right,
Neil. Yeah, who then get, you know, government contracts and then get to spend that government money unlimited to elect whatever politicians they want.
That's right.
Then keep
That's
rewarding
right.
government contracts.
It's a giant cycle feeding itself. You're absolutely right, Neil. Thank you very much. Michael in Baltimore. Hey, Michael. Michael?
Hi, yeah, thank you.
Hey, you're on the air. What's
sorry
up?
Sorry about that.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm calling about the contraception thing, but I'd love to talk about the mortgage thing, but I'll stick to what I said.
Pick one. Either one.
Okay. Well, the contraceptive issue, first of all, I'm not for banning abortion. I'm not for, I think the Catholic Church position on contraceptive is ridiculous.
But see, it's their position, so they're fully entitled to it.
Oh, I agree. But I agree. And people, freedom in a free society, we are entitled to ridiculous positions. The problem here is this is what happens when the federal government tries to get into places where they shouldn't belong. Now, I fully agree that if the best solution constitutionally probably would have been just take Medicare, apply it to everybody.
Yeah.
End of story.
Yep.
But since we tried this Rube Goldberg thing, which is just unbelievably intrusive and bureaucratic and everything like that, this is the problem that we're coming into, where now Obama and his administration is trying to force this down Catholics or whoever. And it's not a situation of, this really isn't about contraceptive. This is about federal control over organizations. You had a good statement about the Seventh-day Adventist. I personally think they shouldn't be forced to serve meat in their cafeteria.
I agree.
That's another thing.
I agree.
And I have firsthand knowledge. I used to be, I won't say which the organization was, but it was a charitable organization that was actually highly sought after by several states because amazing success with children with special needs and that type of thing. Mm-hmm. But they were driven out of a few states because the states started to put mandates on them that certain other parts of their beliefs wouldn't didn't agree with. So
right.
Consequently, the states lost the services of those groups. And these, as a rule, these places are not in it for the money. I mean, good grief, Catholic hospitals are subsidized by the Catholic Church. They're not.
By and large.
Profit making. Yeah. So I think you're pretty reasonable about this. I don't consider myself a liberal. I consider myself a libertarian. I'm definitely not a Republican. But I think the left gets a little out of control here when you listen to most of this debate. Oh, it's all about contraceptive and contraception and stuff like that. And I think that's just wildly missing the mark. And I think that's a big mistake from the Democrats and liberals because they act like this. Conservatives get it. Conservatives say, you know, yeah, we won't do this. But this just shows, you know, what's next? If a conservative gets in power, are you comfortable with the federal government having this type of power? In other words, are you comfortable with the federal government going to the NAACP and saying, you know what, you don't have enough white people working for you? You always have to look at, you may agree with the substance of this one issue, but are you comfortable with the federal government having this type of power? And that's the real thing.
Yeah. Well, I am comfortable with the federal government having this type of power when it comes to the commons. And that's my point, is that the hospitals, Catholic, Seventh-day Adventist, fill in the blank, these hospitals are filling a space in our commons that shouldn't be filled by religious institutions. It should be filled by secular institutions, which would allow the religious institutions to continue to exist. God bless them. Let them keep on doing their work, you know, their great work, but they can do it by themselves, for themselves, with themselves, and they can do it any way that they want. And that's my point. And you're not going to get that until you get a national healthcare system of some consequence. Jeff in Utah. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'm glad you're feeling better.
Thank you.
basically, I live in Utah, and there's a very interesting thing here with birth control. You know, basically, they have the people here take issue with condoms. They take issue with birth control pills. They take issue with hysterectomies and having a woman having her tubes tied. But they have no problem with men having vasectomies.
Really? These are largely Mormon doctrines?
Yeah, largely Mormon, and there's also a Catholic hospital here in the Valley. It is kind of interesting. And I actually had a vasectomy performed. I have one daughter, and she's awesome. And, you know, that's basically all I wanted
Jeff,
to have.
Okay, good. Because, Jeff, I got to wrap it up. Thanks. Interesting point.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Back with more of your thoughts and mine right after this. And I do want to tell you about the Illinois Eavesdropping Act of 1961. This is a big deal. That would be the good, the bad, and the very, very alacrimabliously ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The good, Lelia Burrows. Burrows had one wish before she died last September. She wanted to help the homeless. So she left her condo to the city of San Francisco to turn into a shelter. The city is now deciding whether to convert the Burrows' condo into a shelter or sell it and put the assets into the city's homeless fund. $500,000 condo, expected sale price of the condo, would help the city put up to 150 families in housing or help those facing foreclosure stay in their homes. In a time when corporate greed runs amok, class warfare is all the rage, and millions are living in poverty, it's heartwarming to see a relatively unknown person do so much good for those in need. The bad? Mississippi State Representative Steve Holland. It wasn't clear that there's a growing anti-Mexican immigrant sentiment in many parts of America. Holland came up with a new way to help show Mississippi's particular distaste for Mexicans. He introduced a bill, House Bill 150, that in Mississippi would rename the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America. Here we go with the Freedom Fries controversy all over again. Unfortunately for Holland, he and his amigos can't actually rename an international body of water. They can only change how the state refers to it. Somehow the bill has garnered enough support to make its way to a committee. If approved, it would go into effect just before Independence Day. Great timing. Maybe Holland should focus on more pressing issues like the level of poverty in his state and its subpar education system. And the very, very ugly New Hampshire Republican legislators. New Hampshire's Republican-controlled legislature wants to get rid of lunch breaks. Yep, they recently introduced a bill to repeal a law requiring employers to give their employees time off for lunch. The main rationale for the bill is that all employers will give their workers time for lunch through the goodness of their hearts, just like Scrooge would provide for Bob Cratchit out of the goodness of his heart. New Hampshire Republicans clearly don't remember how many companies like Walmart were sued for denying workers a lunch break. There's simply no room for goodness of the heart in the corporate playbook nowadays. It's all about squeezing whatever profit they can out of their workers. And the New Hampshire legislature thinks that's just fine. And that is very, very ugly. And although they do not sponsor this show, and I have no association with them, I got to tell you, if I was going out looking, and if there was one nearby, I don't know if there is, I don't think there is, but if I was going out looking for clothing right now or anything else that they sell, I would go to a JCPenney's. I don't know if you saw this, but, you know, Ellen DeGeneres has a line of clothes, I believe it's a line of clothing that JCPenney's is selling. And because she's an openly lesbian woman, there has been this hate crusade against her and against JCPenney by one of the fringe right-wing hate groups that I'm not even going to bother to name. And today, the CEO of JCPenney came out. His name is Ron Johnson. He came out and said, "We stand squarely behind Ellen as our spokesperson, and that's a great thing because she shares the same value that we do in our company. Our company was founded 110 years ago on the Golden Rule, which is about treating people fair and square, just like you treat yourself. And we think Ellen represents the values of our company and the values that we share. As we thought about all the people in America, we thought Ellen would be the perfect spokesperson because we all kind of trust her. She's a very honest, straightforward person with extraordinary values. It's been unbelievably wonderful to work with someone who is so kind, so gracious, so funny, and who I just think captures what America is about. That's the CEO of Penny's talking about Ellen DeGeneres. God bless you, sir. It's just, you know, it's every now and then there's a, it's like a dandelion coming through the, you know, a crack in the pavement. Every now and then there's just, you know, something, a little moment of sunlight and you go, wow, you know, life lives, you know, good things happen. It's nice. Ed in Sagano, Michigan. Do I have that right? Ed?
Saginaw, Michigan.
Oh, Saginaw. Yeah, I've been in Saginaw. I'm sorry. It's misspelled here. What's up?
Yeah, you mentioned a little while ago about the CEOs getting their money and the foreclosures.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, most of these people that bought these homes knew they couldn't pay for them. I mean, they didn't have jobs.
Not true.
The old school.
Not true. Not true. First of all, most of these people is absolutely wrong. The percentage of the so-called liar loans, the people who over a period of years wouldn't have been able to afford the homes, is in the single digits. Secondly, even those people who were buying the homes were typically believing the hype that if they simply held the house for a year, they could sell it for $10,000 or $20,000 more than they bought it for and walk away with the profit. That's how this was presented to them. There were people doing seminars on this. There were people doing infomercials on TV on this. There were ads running on radio and TV constantly by respected people, by bankers, by talk show, by everybody. So, no, that's not the case, number one. And number two, even if you took all the liar loans and all the, you know, no, and the ninja note loans, no income, no job, you took all of that stuff and took it off the table, it would have nothing to do with what crashed our economy. What crashed our economy was the banksters taking about $1 trillion worth of loans and turning it into $900 trillion worth of phony instruments, phony debt instruments, and selling them in unregulated markets that were created by Phil and Wendy Graham with the Commodities Futures Modernization Act in 1999 so that Enron could get in the business of selling as a commodity bets on bets on the energy business, and this got extended into housing as a consequence of this. So, anyway, I got no response out. I guess that's, I'll leave it at that. Janet in Palatka, Florida?
Yes, hi.
Hey, Janet.
Glad you're feeling better.
Thank you. I'm getting there.
I'm calling about the conflict between the Catholic Church and the contraception methods.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that when church dogma conflicts with federal law, that federal law has a jurisdiction. I was thinking about the Mormons and the polygamy some few generations ago, that they changed their laws.
Yeah, and in the 1970s they changed their laws about black people being members of the church, too.
Exactly.
Although it was 1978, it was a little late, but yeah, you're right.
Could I mention a related thing, is that Mitt Romney's father was born in Mexico because his father was a Mormon and had several wives, as I understand.
Yep.
And he ran for president. How can that be? And also, John McCain was born in Panama because his father was an admiral, as I understand, on duty. Yep. But was he actually born on embassy property, or was he born in a Panama hospital?
He was not born on embassy property, and I don't know the intricacies of natural birth law. We've been through that. You know, we went through that a few years ago, and we had people on explaining all this stuff. We never got into Mitt's dad, George Romney. So I don't, frankly, Janet, I don't remember the unique weirdnesses of the law of what makes a natural born citizen and what doesn't, and I'm not sure that it's ever been, you know, actually clearly defined. Mitt's grandfather and great grandfather were polygamists, and that's why they went to Mexico. You know, he made the joke the other day about how his dad came from Mexico and all this stuff. Well, yeah, they went to Mexico so that they could have like a dozen wives. and exactly. and one of them was a very, very young teenager. And so, anyhow, Janet, thank you for the call. I suspect this is the kind of stuff that's going to come back and haunt Mitt as the race continues. Sam in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. Hey, Sam, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, I hate to tell you this, but you are contagious.
You think so?
The progressives, like your talk show.
Okay. So the talk show is contagious. All right, good. That's good to know.
Yeah, you're contagious that way.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, have you got fling down in your throat, man? I know an old hillbilly remedy. You can take you some warm salt water and gargle it. Be sure not to swallow any, and then spit it out, and then take some warm water and gargle again. I
yeah,
might
that's
bring a phlegm out of there.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I've been taking guaifenesin. You know, it's a South American tree or herb made out of the bark of a South American tree, but it breaks up the mucus in your lungs and it makes me feel a lot better. But I know about the salt water gargle. I don't have a sore throat though, so that's all gone now. All the symptoms are gone, other than there's still some residual coughing. So that's why I'm here.
Well, I just got off chemo yesterday, and I've been under the weather. I didn't know you were sick, or I said a prayer for you.
Well, thank you, Sam. I appreciate it.
But anyways, you know, on them banks, the way they did people on them loans and everything?
Yeah.
It was strange. About 10 or 12 months before they fell down, I started getting these strange electrical fees on my checking account and my debit card. Companies that were subcontracting or something. I think it was just all big Wall Street scandal to begin with, just to rip off as many people as they could.
Well, they were trying to get you to refi, you mean?
No, they charged me fees.
Oh.
The company would charge me a fee, and the bank would charge me a fee, and then there's some other company came in there, like Dave's Accountant or something. Yeah. I mean, I got overdrawn for $1,500 that year.
Holy cow.
That's a bunch of bull.
Yeah.
To me.
Well, I hope you did something about it, Sam. I hope you put us out
I
to
did.
It.
I did. I complained, and okay. I got a letter, and called them, and I guess they won, though.
Yeah,
they won out court, right?
Well, the banks win more often than they lose, and I think that they're going to win again here, and it's a sad thing. Sam, thanks a lot for the call. This is why we need to get, and thanks for your kind words and your prayer. This is, and I'm mine to you, too, on your chemo, buddy. This is why we need to get money out of politics.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. More with the final thoughts for the day and the Illinois Eavesdropping Act of 1961.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome. And, I promised you I'd tell you about the Illinois Eavesdropping Act of 1961. I'll do this very quickly. This law was passed in 61, and it basically was passed, I believe, to protect police officers from being audiotaped in a way that might compromise a police investigation. But, you know, so a couple of cops are sitting around talking about, hey, you know, on Thursday we're going to bust Charlie for running numbers out of 123 Acme Street. Then, you know, somebody tape recorded that, and even if they're standing around the corner or something like that, and then played it back for Charlie, you know, he'd get out of the way and wouldn't get busted. So anyhow, they passed this law in 61, the Illinois Eavesdropping Act, and it makes it illegal to record a police officer, and which means that with this G8 meeting that's coming up, the G8 and NATO meeting that's coming up in Chicago in May, that there's going to be thousands of people from around the world coming to protest, and there's going to be lots of police there. And if you're standing there with your video camera and you tape and you record them and there's any audio to it, and it may be that the law is broad enough that it includes video. It originally was written to specify audio, but presumably it would include video as well. You could go to prison for 15 years. So this is something that the superintendent of the Chicago police, Gary McCarthy, has said needs to be struck down. And a state representative by the name of Elaine Nekritz, N-E-K-R-I-T-S, has proposed an amendment to the law to allow for the recording of police in public places. Not in private, you know, not inside their cars and things like that, you know, but you know, so still, you know, if they're going to have a discussion about busting Charlie on Thursday, they can do that in private. But if they're going to be out in public, you can record them. And this is really a big deal. This is really important. So if you're listening in Illinois, if you're listening on WCPT or any of the other venues through which you can get our program in the state of Illinois, get together with State Representative Elaine Netkritz. Ask her how you can participate, how you can help. Or contact your state representative or your state senator and say, you know, I'm all in favor of that amendment to the Illinois Eavesdropping Act of 1961 that will make it legal for us to tape the police, particularly with the stuff that may be coming down in May when the G8 and NATO summits come to Chicago. Van in Crown Point, Indiana. Hey, Van, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. It's a pleasure to talk to you. First of all, I'm sure you may tire of hearing it, but I'm thankful for your voice on television, and you're probably one of the only outside of Norman Goldman, 99.9, the only person who seems to talk sense to me in the world.
Thank you,
of politics.
What's on your mind?
Really, really appreciate your work. I just had one question for you. How do you manage to talk to these ultra-right think tankers who try to make a case for ripping off the American people with their agenda of right-wing politics?
Well, there's two. First of all, I find that they fall into two categories. There are the people who are doing it because they're paid to do it and they don't really believe it. And there are the people who are doing it because they've bought the philosophy. They read Ayn Rand's book. They've studied Friedrich von Hayek. They believe it. They actually believe it. I think Ron Paul falls into that latter category. I think Eric Cantor is in the former category. He's a hustler. I think Paul Ryan's in the former category. He's a hustler, although maybe he's a true believer. So, first of all, by and large, I don't debate the people who I know are just being paid to mouth the words, because it's not that interesting a debate. Usually you can eat them alive fairly quickly. And B, it's like, why bother, right? But the people who actually are the true believers, I think that it's important to debate them. I think it's important to engage them. And frankly, you know, this program has been on the air for 9 years, and I don't know how long you've been watching or listening to it, but there are a number of people on the right, some of them not on the professional right, but even a couple on the professional right, who over the years, as a result of debating me, have ended up becoming progressives. And I just think it's important for us to model how to do that to other people. I know that, you know, I had the good fortune of having a parent. My father disagreed with me politically. He was a conservative Republican to the day he died, although he thought conservative meant Dwight Eisenhower's policies and maybe Barry Goldwater's policies. But we used to fight like cats and dogs, and at the end of the day, we still loved each other. And I got it that you can have a political disagreement with somebody who is still a human being. And I constantly come across people who don't know how to do that. And I think that we've lost that. I think in America we've siloized ourselves. You know, Republicans only read, you know, redstate.com or whatever. You know, they only read their right-wing websites. Liberals only read their left-wing websites. And the result is that we're not having the kind of discourse that we used to have in this country and that, frankly, I think we need. And that's why, you know, we try every single day to have somebody on with an opposing point of view. A, I think that by having both points of views represented, it illuminates it. It brings both points of view out into clear open, and rational people can make up their mind. And B, I'm not afraid to lose an argument. If I'm wrong, I'll admit it. And C, I think it's really important to role model for people. Here's a way that you can debate with somebody without having to resort to ad hominems. I mean, only on a couple of occasions over all these years have I ever resorted to calling somebody an idiot. And every single time I regretted it and I apologized. You know, it's something that I think we all need to learn to do, because we all have those people as our, you know, strange brother-in-law, or the guy who works in the cubicle next to you, or, you know, the guy that, you know, you're sitting watching the Super Bowl with or whatever. And so that's why I do it. Van, thank you for your kind words, and thanks for watching us there in Crown Point, Indiana. We'll be back tomorrow, and hopefully I'll get better and better, and I'll be back tomorrow with Bernie Sanders, Brunch with Bernie, Nate, the America's Senator. And, of course, anything goes Friday. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, show up, occupy something. Occupying the airwaves, Tom Hartman here with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.